Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking primarily about pharmacology, and we'll touch upon things like, why does smoking cause cancer? You know it does, but I'm not sure you know why. I certainly do not. But we're going to be talking to Professor Jeff Field. He's from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And Jeff Field, welcome to Science Studio.
Hello, Keith, and thanks for inviting me down here.
Well, it's a great pleasure. Before we get into smoking, cancer, pharmacology, biology, let's talk just a little about Jeff Field. Interested in how our guests on this program get into their careers, get into science. What's your story?
Okay, I guess growing up in the Northeast in a Jewish family and showing some interest in science, the natural career path I was directed towards by my family was to become a physician.
Of course.
Since I was very small age, you know, be a doctor and whatever, I kept getting shoved in that direction. And I actually remember one conversation I had with my dad, and I think he was more pleased with it at the end of it than I was, where at that time I was interested in oceanography and biology. I still regard myself more as a biologist than a pharmacologist. And he managed to convince me that what I should do is become a doctor because I would earn a lot of money and then I could have oceanography as a hobby.
Right. You mean buy a yacht, yeah, is what he
and
meant.
And he was actually quite pleased after that conversation because I think he did manage to convince me. In college, I did the pre-med program and
So you kept them stringing along for the longest period of time,
right,
while they supported you in college, right?
And so the fallback career was that, well, if I didn't get into medical school, I was going to be into bioengineering. So I actually entered a bioengineering program at Columbia. And you don't take your first engineering courses or biology courses and as a freshman there. You take those as a sophomore. And I began my sophomore year and was taking an introductory biology course and introductory engineering course at the same time. And I found that I was actually, you know, enamored by the biology, staying up late, reading beyond the curriculum and so forth. And on the other hand, the engineering course I detested.
Did you have to wear a tie for the engineering class?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
So I actually, in a few weeks, managed to sort of close that door, drop out of the engineering program, and then go into the biology program, whereupon I got an angry call from my mother saying that, "You're crazy. All you're ever going to do with a degree in biology is wash test tubes."
What did she know about biology? Was she a professional lady?
Yes, she was actually a teacher, a second grade teacher, and had majored in biology and really couldn't get a career developed in that area. So
Okay. She
had taken some teaching courses as a fallback, and i.e. had wanted me to take the engineering courses as well. But I was pretty determined to just, there was no way that I was going to do the engineering part. From my point of view, I felt that by the time engineers got involved in a problem, the discoveries had been made already, and they were trying to commercialize it, do it more efficiently, or make it practical.
Right.
And the interesting stuff had already been done by, in that case, the biologist, because I was interested in bioengineering.
But you were still thinking of MD school?
Still, yeah. I went through the pre-med program.
Right.
And I'm probably one of the world's worst interview subjects. And when I did apply to med school and went to a number of interviews, and I said some pretty, I wouldn't exactly call them politically incorrect, but interview incorrect type things, criticizing the whole healthcare system and how it's not providing health care to the people who need it, and how they're training white students using black patients so they can go back and after they get their degrees practice on white patients again. And so
okay, so that door closed also.
Yeah, so I didn't.
Very nice.
And so at some point there I had some research experience and I found that I took to the laboratory like a fish to water.
Good.
And I really enjoyed the time that I spent there and then wound up in a PhD program at where I had done one of those summer programs. In this case was Einstein, which is a It's a medical school
right.
in the Bronx that has a PhD program. That was where
okay.
I did my
so
that, PhD.
That's a nice long story, in fact. But just before we get on to pharmacology and what Jeff Field does there, your parents, did they get any young child of theirs to go become a doctor?
No.
Oh, well, dear.
Does a PhD count?
Okay, so pharmacology. You didn't start in pharmacology, as you noted, but tell us, what is pharmacology? What makes that different from pharmacy, for example, or toxicology? Discuss that.
So where we are at Penn, we have two primary responsibilities in our training. And so we train medical students how to use drugs and the courses that we teach for that, the major course, what we call medical pharmacology. And that is a fairly straightforward course where we either present drugs, and these are the diseases that you treat with these drugs, or we present the diseases, and these are the drugs that you use to treat the diseases. And so that is basically preparing them for when they need to use drugs later on as they become practicing physicians. The other teaching mission that we have is on the graduate level, where we prepare PhD students for careers in drug development, usually in the pharmaceutical industry. Almost every drug on the market these days comes out of industry. And that's because industry is really geared for product development. And it is incredibly expensive, and a lot of that has to do with the very rigorous testing that goes on with the drugs. And besides the actual science that goes into the drug, there's a very carefully constructed set of safety studies, first in animals, and then what we call efficacy studies, also in animals. And then they start going into clinical trials, and there's a whole series of steps that they go through. We call phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, and phase 4 trials. And those are very expensive. Estimates from pharmaceutical companies range from about $800 million to $1 billion for each new drug that comes to the market. But right. we want to make sure that what goes into patients is actually effective against the treatment and is safe. And the other thing is, on the chemical side, they need to be pure so that each batch is, right. is the same. And all of those require rigorous testing. And it's really beyond the financial resources of any academic institution. That said about product development, probably 90% or so of the ideas that lead to drugs come out of the academic community. And those are usually an idea generated by a single graduate student or postdoctoral fellow working at the bench in a very crude and preliminary way, suggesting that this particular strategy might lead towards a new drug. And so I think that is probably what we do at the research level, and what our PhD students do is loosely connected towards understanding disease mechanisms, perhaps with a long-term idea that someone may actually be able to turn this into a practical product.
I mean, that response brings up all sorts of interesting sort of diversionary avenues for a discussion. But one that comes to my mind, there are a lot of stories where you find what are sort of called off-prescription drugs. You know, a drug has been designed and has been given permission to be used, at least in North America and Europe, for a particular disease. And then people begin to find out later, you know, from studies following the patients for one reason, that they suddenly say, hey, this group of patients is improving their arthritic condition, for example. I mean, there's many, many of these stories, which is, it's not exactly serendipity, but where the drug, very efficacious in one area, turns out to be useful in a totally different area. Do you have in your program or any programs those types of a course, you know, where you can say, look, here is, you know, the accidental use of drugs for a different disease? Because it's always intrigued me how those other drugs can work in a totally different disease.
We don't have a formal way of presenting that.
Right.
And so many of those are accidental in that they have to do with clinical observations and what we call anecdotal evidence, and that careful physicians and astute physicians who are treating patients with that drug notice that it might help improve another condition, and they start using that. And those are informal, and so they're just completely unpredictable. And we don't have a way of formally teaching that or even studying that.
But in a sense, I mean, it's all documented. I mean, I suppose if I knew where to look, or you did, or you know where to look, you'd be able to find this list of drugs that have originally been created for disease A, which have subsequently been given permission by the FDA to be used for other diseases. I mean, so it shouldn't be too difficult to locate all those drugs, or am I wrong?
Well, yeah, that's all published information. And
right.
You can
so
these days find it on the web by looking at what we call off-label uses.
Oh, it's off-label is the expression. Well, I'm sort of intrigued in that. I'm wondering if somebody hasn't written a book, because, you know, just the whole process of the serendipity discovery of good drugs, which, you know, is much cheaper in a sense, because somebody else has already done the testing for a different disease, and so you know that they're sort of reasonably safe.
Right, and it's also a gray area that some companies have gotten themselves into trouble over, because they either directly or indirectly promote this use off-label when they are only sanctioned based on their clinical trials for the main use that's the approved use. And in some cases, those off-label uses are not properly documented and are even unsafe compared to traditional treatments for the other diseases. And companies have gotten in trouble and have gotten fined. I know there was a recent case. I can't think of it specifically, but a company was
so when that serendipity occurs, you've got to treat it with a little bit of a kid glove. You don't promote it too much until you've got permission from the FDA.
Right.
And that usually comes, I gather.
It will come after rigorous clinical trials for these other uses, and those are decisions that companies weigh for choices like that. One of the things that companies always look at, the major thing that always look at, is bottom line. And if a drug is nearing the end of its patent life and generic compounds are going to soon be available, they may decide it's not cost-effective for an additional clinical trial on a drug that's going to not make them as much profit, even if the market is expanded. And those are all business decisions.
We'll come back to that after a short break. Mm-hmm. My name is Keith Paddle. I'm here with Jeff Field, professor of pharmacology from Penn, and we'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Dave, the summer weather brings out two things, barbecue and ticks.
True, but how are the two related?
That's what's interesting. A person bit by a Lone Star tick can develop a severe allergy to meat.
I knew about Lyme disease, but meat allergy?
I know. This happens because some people bitten by the tick develop antibodies against a complex sugar called galactose alpha-1,3-galactose, or alpha-gal.
Alpha-gal is in all non-primate-derived proteins, which means it's in pork, beef, and lamb. The main symptom is a hive-like rash, but some people develop life-threatening anaphylactic shock. It takes 4 to 6 hours after eating meat for symptoms to show, so people don't associate their rash with meat.
The allergy to alpha-gal was first discovered among cancer patients with an unusual sensitivity to a cancer drug, cetuximab, which also includes alpha-gal molecules. These patients were almost exclusively from the southeastern U.S., where the Lone Star tick lives.
It's still unclear what in tick saliva triggers this response. Ticks can latch onto its host for days and transmit a variety of pathogens, including viruses and bacteria. But tick saliva also contains molecules that influence a host's blood coagulation, immune response, and angiogenesis, which is the development of new blood vessels.
For all of us who love barbecue, the only way to avoid developing a meat allergy is to avoid tick bites. The downside is the Lone Star tick's territory may be continually expanding, but evidence suggests the allergy eventually goes away, as long as you don't get any more tick bites.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Paddle, Jeff Field, talking about drugs, talking about their discovery, their use, their off-label uses, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like to come back to generics in a few moments, because that poses some incredibly big ethical problems. But before that, I'd like to learn a little bit more, and so would our audience, about what you are precisely studying. And I know it's to do with smoking and what are the reasons that smoking causes this incredibly nasty lung cancer.
I guess I'll introduce this topic by saying, for me, it's a relatively new area of research, and that I would say that most of my career I've been more interested in trying to cure cancer. But a few years ago, an opportunity through a colleague in the department became available, Professor Trevor Penning, who's worked closely with me on this project. And I probably best describe this as moving over to the dark side and saying that, well, sometimes it's of academic interest to find out what causes cancer as well as what cures it. Let's see if I can describe this project in lay terms a little more easily. We're interested in understanding how smoking causes cancer. And cigarette smoke is a very complex mixture of compounds. And to make things more complicated, it's not just the tobacco, but it's actually products of combustion. But one of the most widely acknowledged carcinogens in the smoke is a group of compounds called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. These compounds are not unique to cigarette smoke. They're products of combustion. So when anything burns, wood stoves, coal-fired stoves, diesel exhaust, some of the products released are these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And they were first found to be carcinogens in the 1700s when it was found that young boys were getting testicular cancers and scrotal cancers. These boys were chimney sweeps, and they would be going up and down the chimneys. And young boys were used because they were smaller and they can fit into the chimneys, and they were lowered down to clean them out in Great Britain. And they were covered head to toe in soot and started a field of looking at the compounds in the soot that would cause cancer. In the 50s and 60s, we learned a lot more about how they are causing cancers, mostly in studies with animals where they were painted on the skin of rats and cancer would result. But what happens to them once they get inside a cell is not straightforward. There's a complex set of metabolic reactions that convert these into something that we call an ultimate carcinogen, and the ultimate carcinogen is what actually damages the DNA. We, through our collaboration with Dr. Penning, found a new way that these are metabolically activated through a set of genes that just a few months ago were shown by a number of groups to be what we call smoking response genes. So these are genes that are normally not expressed at very high levels, but when patients are or smokers are exposed to these cigarette smoke, and in the cases of those studies that were actually using cigarette smoke, there's a very high level of expression of these genes. And then equally as important, after the patients stop smoking, these genes go back down. So these are what we call smoking response genes. And we found that what they can do is modify these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons in such a way that they can now become more DNA reactive and become what we call ultimate carcinogens. They do this by getting chemically modified by the enzymes that I spoke about a moment ago, and they produce very high levels of reactive oxygen, and it's actually the reactive oxygen that damaged the DNA.
The smoking response genes, then, are they in response to the polycyclic aromatics or other ingredients in the smoke that then happen to be capable of modifying the PACs?
That's a very good question, and I don't think that we know the answers to that yet. But we suspect in some cases it's the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and in other cases it's other components in the cigarette smoke.
I've got a colleague here, Professor Bill Herndon, who spent a lot of time doing quantum mechanical studies and efficacy or virulence of causing cancers with these very molecules you're talking about. And I remember little areas, not all of these polycyclic aromatics are equally potent in causing cancer. You know, so it's different regions, bay areas, whereas there's the molecules sort of encapsulate a little bit of free space. You're familiar with that type of activity?
Yes, yes. There are bay area ones, there are fjord area ones, and so forth. Yeah. I forget. Sometimes I'm talking with a chemist here who knows this material. I may have to switch to the biology so that I can.
So that
I can keep ahead of my interviewer here.
But But the point is that the smoking response gene, there's any structure, guest host relationship that one can recognize as why they can see certain areas of a molecule compared to another.
So we have not studied that intensely. Some of our colleagues have in the field. And one of the reasons why we believe that there's this additional pathway that we've been working on is that there isn't a clear what we call order of potency between those different classes of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and the traditional ways of activation that have been well established. And we felt that other pathways must explain why some are more carcinogenic than others.
How do you do the experiment? I mean, you have cancer cells, you have your polycyclic aromatics, you have your smoking response gene. How do you go about doing an experiment?
So we took a somewhat unorthodox approach to that, and we're not using cancer cells at all for this. It turns out the gene that we're interested in studying, a gene called P53, which is actually the most commonly mutated gene in cancers, and it's mutated in about half of all cancers, won't be mutated in the traditional animal studies and cancer cell studies that are used. Instead, what we've done is use yeast, baker's yeast, the same yeast that's used to bake bread or brew beer. It turns out that this P53 will function on inappropriate, what we call reporter systems in the yeast. And the mutant P53, the one seen in cancers, won't function, and we can use our yeast to distinguish when the gene has been mutated. So our experimental paradigm is to treat DNA, toast it as we may see fit with our various mechanisms of testing the compounds that we're testing, then introduce that DNA into the yeast and then select out the various yeasts that grow that have a mutant or else the wild-type protein.
So you just bathe the material, the yeast, with the compound for a certain... Do you actually roast it? Do you heat it? Do you cool it?
I mean, it's mixed together in a test tube.
Okay. So there are other people... Right. You finally got the test tubes make a living. This is wonderful. So you put the yeast in with the polycyclic aromatic. You let them stir together for whatever period of time. Then do you separate out the cells again or the yeast and remove, or do you add the actual smoking response gene to that mixture?
Well, what we're doing is we're not working with that smoking response gene. We're working with the products of it, a modified form called quinones. And we mix the quinones directly with DNA, and then we get the yeast to take up the DNA. And the power of using this is what we call a genetic reporter system. This is set up so that the yeast turn red if they have a mutation in it. So we'll look at a plate of colonies with hundreds of white colonies, and there will be a half a dozen or a dozen red colonies. And then we isolate the DNA from the red colonies and sequence it.
Okay. So tell the audience and me. I mean, I know that you've got all sorts of cells out there that have all markers with fluorescence, which green fluorescent proteins and all this good stuff. How do you make just the mutants turn red? Because I would have thought you could mutate it in so many different ways that they wouldn't all have the response of turning red.
This is set up, I would say, probably best as a simple on-off switch. We have a gene that when you switch it on, in this case, it turns the red yeast white. So we start out with a red yeast. And if the gene is on, it turns white. If it's mutant, and there are many different types of mutations that will cause it, it will turn red.
I mean, it sounds so simple. It's like a traffic light, but that sounds like a very interesting setup. So you've been doing it for some time. What results do you have? Can you tell us something that's new that's been developed?
So what we have done is compared our results in yeast with a fingerprint in lung cancer. And it turns out that P53, the gene that we work on, has a signature in lung cancer that's different than what's seen in other cancers. And that has to do with types and the locations of the mutations seen in the gene. And what we've found is that the chemistry that I've described here, as well as the genetic selection that we can do in yeast, together will lead to something very closely approximating that fingerprint. So we have the same types of mutations, and they're in the same locations as is seen in lung cancer. And so we've put out a new idea here about how the combination of chemical carcinogenesis plus certain selection systems, particular for this gene, will lead to the mutation seen in lung cancer.
You talk about lung cancer, and yet I remember we looked into this a little bit in recent years. There are many types of lung cancer. I mean, it's just not that there's lung cancer. So does this apply across the board, or is this specific to one form?
Well, the many types of lung cancer are almost all caused by smoking. About 90% of lung cancer is caused by smoking. And the signature seen in the DNA is not that different and probably has to do with the specific cells that are hit by these carcinogens, as well as the timing.
Okay, so it's quite a general test, in fact, then.
Right. Well, so I'd like to talk about this project in particular to undergraduate students and even high school students when I teach them, because it's something that they can actually do. And in fact, this project for me for many years has been a bit of an orphan project, working in the shadows and things that I worked on in the summers away from my main research. And it's in part because until very recently, I didn't have independent funding for it. And so I was, believe it or not, sometimes us professors go back into the labs themselves. But for the most part, I was guiding undergraduates. And in the case of our most recent paper on the topic, it was actually a high school student who did a lot of the work with me. So the technique is fairly straightforward and easy to explain and to teach the students, and doesn't require a lot of laboratory skills.
Can you actually explain simply, as you would to the high school students, how the process and why it comes right, or is that a little bit beyond?
There is a gene that's involved in adenine biosynthesis, and adenine is a metabolite, and when that gene is missing, there's kind of an accumulation of the steps that and the products that lead up to that missing step. And coincidentally, one of those is red and causes the yeast to turn red. And so that's why our mutants are red. It's just one of those clever things that geneticists have worked out years ago and has been integrated into studying this gene that I look at. If I can give one last take-home message from all of this, is that we don't know how to stop lung cancer. So if you smoke, please stop smoking. And if you don't smoke, don't start.
Amen. It's been very good to have you here. I wanted to get into the ethics associated with, you know, making generic drugs, but I think we'll do that at another program. Thank you very much for being here on Science Studio.
And thank you, Keith. I enjoyed myself very much here.
That's lovely. And Norma Martinez, thank you very much for the smile and putting the whole program together. Thank you very much to the audience. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Fernanda Tejeda with your Synapse Flash. Robert Resendez is the new public health director over the El Paso Department of Public Health. He was part of the national search that included interview panels with internal and external community stakeholders. Resendez comes to El Paso with 3 decades of public health and private sector experience. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.